Today is Tuesday, November 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine holds a military drill amid fears of a Russian troop buildup along the border.
General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has spoken with his Ukrainian counterpart about what's going on with Russia and those troop movements.
President Biden nominates Jerome Powell for a second term as Federal Reserve Chair.
In a statement, the president endorses Powell's stewardship of the economy through a brutal pandemic recession.
And Ethiopia's prime minister says he will lead his country's army, quote, from the battlefront, unquote, as the fight for the capital looms. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine's defense ministry says it has held a military drill of airborne forces close to the capital, Kyiv, in response to a buildup of Russian troops near its borders. A ministry statement says the drill simulated the landing of airborne troops and armored personnel carriers for an attack on an enemy target. Last week, Ukrainian Marines conducted exercises near the borders of Russia and next Crimea. The head of Ukraine's military intelligence told the Military Times outlet last weekend that Russia had more than 92,000 troops amassed around Ukraine's borders and was preparing for an attack by the end of January or beginning of February. The Kremlin on Monday dismissed the suggestion and said it was alarmed that Ukraine was being supplied with large quantities of weapons and building up its own forces. Ukraine, which aspires to become a NATO member, received a large consignment of U.S. ammunition earlier this year and Javelin anti-tank missiles, prompting criticism from Moscow, which has said it has serious security concerns about the prospects of Ukraine joining NATO one day. In the next few days, Ukraine will also receive two refitted former U.S. Coast Guard patrol boats designed to beef up its navy. The U.S. has expressed concern about the buildup of Russian forces close to the Ukraine border. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin says the administration is keeping a close eye on the area and is calling on Moscow to defuse tension along the border by withdrawing its troops. NATO has also reassured Ukraine of support. For more on Washington plans, I spoke with VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden.
We have, though, seen an evolution in the Pentagon's language over the past several weeks. Just earlier this month, the highest-ranking, most senior general for the United States, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, was speaking at a security conference, and he said that the U.S. was monitoring what he called a significant amount of military movement on the Russian side of the Ukrainian border, but he said it was nothing overtly aggressive and nothing that the U.S. hasn't seen before. Now, more recently, just the past week, we've heard from the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who said that the movements, quote, certainly have our attention, and he reaffirmed the U.S.'s unwavering support for Ukraine. And even more recently, in the past 4 days, twice, General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, has spoken with his Ukrainian counterpart about what's going on with Russia and those troop movements. So it appears that the level of concern is steadily rising, and Washington is taking this very seriously.
There are fears by some analysts that U.S. one way or the other may be drawn into the conflict, either directly by support for Ukraine or through NATO.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. The Pentagon has repeatedly affirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine. We've also seen earlier this month a number of exercises, including air exercise, where NATO and U.S. long-range bombers flew over the Black Sea in a show of strength, perhaps messaging to Moscow about what it's doing. We've also heard the U.S. call out Moscow repeatedly and call on the Kremlin to be more transparent about what they're doing. Of course, there is a high degree of suspicion, and the U.S. has said that some of what Russia is doing is unusual. U.S. has given Ukraine a considerable amount of aid. There's $150 million aid package that was given to Ukraine earlier this year. Ukraine is asking for more. Will the U.S. give it? That remains to be seen. There's also quite a bit of concern because we've heard a lot about disinformation in this space. And just earlier on Monday, Ukraine's foreign minister said that Russia is feeding the disinformation environment, trying to create some instability and trying to create the sense that it's Ukraine that's going to act first. So the U.S. is walking a very difficult line here, voicing support from Ukraine along with the U.S.'s NATO allies, but at the same time, realizing that a larger conflict is probably something that is in nobody's interest and hoping to deter it in some way, shape, or form. We've seen a flurry of meetings in the U.S. on the phone, but a lot of this will just just have to play out. And part of it may come down to what type of risk is Russia willing to assume? How much is Russia willing to push the boundaries into conflict? And just earlier, within the last 24 hours, Russian officials were comparing the situation to what happened with Georgia in 2008 when Russian forces invaded Georgia and intimated that Georgia at that point paid a very heavy price. There's a lot of concern that Russia may be pushing those boundaries yet again.
Some security experts fear another Crimea by Russia. How real is this in terms of the security analysis?
It's going to come down in part to what Russia is playing at. And at least publicly, the United States says they don't know. They want Russia to be more transparent about what its goals are, what its aims are here, and that Russia owes it to the international community to be more forthcoming on that. Russia has not been, of course. So part of it is going to come down to what Russia ultimately wants to do. Is it trying to just create a show of force? Remember, this is not the first time that Russia has massed forces along its border with Ukraine in eastern Ukraine. Back in April, it massed about 100,000 to 150,000 troops in that area before eventually pulling those troops back and sending them back to their home bases. The most recent estimates suggest that Russia currently has about 90,000 troops. There is a sense of perhaps this is more dangerous, more foreboding.
That's VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon speaking with me from Washington. The Senate majority leader wants to get President Biden's social agenda spending bill done by Christmas and sees negotiations within the party ahead. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The Senate Majority Leader wants to get President Biden's social agenda spending bill done by Christmas and sees negotiations within the party ahead. Senator Chuck Schumer says he knows his own Democratic Party is diverse.
It runs from Bernie Sanders to Joe Manchin. But I tell our party, as leader of the party, that in unity is our strength. If any one person insists that unless they get a certain provision that someone else can't be with, the bill fails.
He says so far on all major bills, Democrats have stayed unified, even without Republican votes.
I think that we're in very good shape to get 50 votes.
Schumer also wants to make sure a provision to cap insulin at $35 a month remains in the bill. His comments come days after the House passed the $1.9 trillion plan. I'm Julie Walker.
President Biden says he's nominating Jerome Powell for a second term as Federal Reserve Chair. AP correspondent Mike Hampen has the story.
President Biden says he's nominating Jerome Powell for a second term as Federal Reserve Chair. In a statement, the president endorses Powell's stewardship of the economy through a brutal pandemic recession in which the Fed's ultra-low rate policies help bolster confidence and revitalize the job market. Biden also says he'll nominate Lael Brainard, the only Democrat on the Fed's Board of Governors, as vice chair, the number two position. Two other slots on the Fed's board remain vacant, as does the position of vice chair for supervision, a bank regulatory post. Biden says those positions will be filled early next month. Mike Hemp in Washington.
As people in the United States prepare to gather for the Thanksgiving Day holiday on Thursday, health authorities continue to push for vaccination to protect against COVID-19 and says all inoculated adults can get the booster shot. Michelle Quinn reports.
People are expected to travel at pre-pandemic levels this week as they visit loved ones for Thanksgiving, which kicks off the holiday season in the United States. COVID-19 infection rates are rising in the U.S., however, and health officials just endorsed all vaccinated adults receiving a booster shot. But gathering comes with risks, with 26% of Americans, including those 5 and older, yet to receive one shot, officials say. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the White House's chief medical advisor. He spoke to ABC this week.
If you're vaccinated, and hopefully you'll be boosted too, and your family is, you can enjoy a typical Thanksgiving meal, Thanksgiving holiday with your family. There's no reason not to do that. The thing we are concerned about is the people who are not vaccinated, because what they're doing is they're the major source of the dynamics of the infection in the community.
Some strategies to increase the vaccination rate are running into roadblocks. The Biden administration said it would pause for now plans to implement a workplace vaccine mandate for employers with 100 or more workers, pending a court challenge. Last week, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, signed a law imposing fines on businesses and hospitals that require inoculation against COVID-19 without alternatives. And Disney World, a big employer in the state, put its worker vaccination policy on hold. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis spoke while signing the bill.
And I think it's something that's going to make a big, big difference for an awful lot of people. We are respecting people's individual freedom in this state.
The Biden administration's efforts to tie employment with vaccination has become a political issue, some say. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, appeared on CBS Face the Nation.
Now it's become a political fight at a national level, unfortunately. You're going to see some governors trying to position themselves on this issue, like you've seen in Florida. And you're going to see the federal government, the Biden administration, now fighting those states.
While efforts to vaccinate more people continue, some are ready to loosen rules around mask wearing. The mayor of Washington, D.C. said the city's indoor mask mandate would be lifted this week. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
People took to the streets in several European countries over the weekend to protest tighter coronavirus restrictions. As part of the EU's record spikes in cases, elected officials in some of these nations have begun limiting public life for the unvaccinated. VOA Arash Arabasadi has more.
Carrying a banner that read "Together in Freedom," protesters marched through Belgium's capital Brussels Sunday against tightening measures to curb the spread of COVID-19. The crowd lobbed smoke bombs and firecrackers to protest moves such as barring unvaccinated people from bars and restaurants. Friday, on the streets of Rotterdam in the Netherlands, protests turned violent as demonstrators torched police cars after the government announced plans for coronavirus lockdown measures like so-called corona passes that show proof of vaccination or recovery from infection. Police used water cannons and opened fire on the crowd in what the city's mayor called an orgy of violence. Five police officers were injured there, with at least 28 people detained and some hospitalized with suspected gunshot wounds. By Saturday, fireworks became part of the mix as people protested a New Year's Eve fireworks ban to avoid putting added pressure on hospitals dealing with surges of COVID-19. Daily infection rates in the Netherlands remain at their highest since the start of the pandemic. Meanwhile, in Austria, where the daily COVID death rate recently tripled, roughly 35,000 people protested in Vienna following Chancellor Alexander Schallenberg's announcement that the entire population would have to be vaccinated by February. With roughly two-thirds of the population fully vaccinated, Austria has one of the lowest inoculation rates in all of Europe, so the government introduced a national lockdown. Protesters say they want their freedom back.
This has been going on for 2 years, and there's no end in sight. Something new is announced every day, and we don't know what we can believe anymore. That's the situation.
Austria's far-right Freedom Party organized the demonstration along with the anti-vaccine MFG party and another far-right group. The Freedom Party leader was unable to attend after testing positive for COVID-19. Some Austrians say another lockdown was inevitable.
There's no other way, even though I don't like it. In literature, you can read that pandemics last at least 3 years, and we should avoid that.
At a news conference Friday in Berlin, Germany's acting health minister said hospitals were overflowing with COVID cases and may need to transfer patients to neighboring countries. Germany's head of infectious disease prevention said the COVID situation is out of control.
This is no longer about individual outbreaks. The whole of Germany is one big outbreak. This is a national emergency. We have to pull the emergency brake now. The thresholds have been exceeded.
As neighboring Austria prepares for a nationwide lockdown on Monday, German officials say they cannot rule out doing the same, even for the vaccinated. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Kenya's Ministry of Health has announced that anyone not vaccinated against COVID-19 by December 21st will be refused in-person government services and access to public gatherings, parks, hotels, restaurants, and bars. Brenda Mulinya reports from Nairobi.
Kenyans have less than 1 month to get the COVID-19 vaccine or risk losing the right to access in-person government services. Minister for Health Mutahi Kagwe Sunday announced new measures aimed at nudging vaccine-shy citizens towards getting the jab before the end of the year.
We must take cue from the rest of the world and learn from them. A worrisome epidemiological picture is emerging in the European countries, in the Netherlands, Austria, France, Belgium, United Kingdom, Australia, and the United States of America, where new COVID-19 cases have surged. And that is despite quite a bit of drive in vaccinations.
The Kenyan government says the move is aimed at ensuring that the country meets its target of vaccinating at least 10 million people by the end of the year. Currently, there are about 6.5 million doses of the vaccine that have been administered since the vaccination kicked off, with only 2.4 million people fully vaccinated, or less than 10% of Kenya's adult population.
We are given sufficient time for people to go through this exercise so that post-21st, people then don't start accusing police of harassing them.
The announcement of the new measures yet to be implemented come as the country gears towards a peak in holiday-related travel and public gatherings, sparking fears of a resurgence in the spread of the virus that has been on a downward trend in recent months. The measures will also limit non-vaccinated people from visiting entertainment spots, hotels and restaurants, as well as hospitals. The unvaccinated will also be limited in the access of public transport systems, including air and rail transport. A 10-day COVID-19 vaccination drive to help get as many people on board as possible begins this Tuesday across Kenya. Brenda Molinya for VOA News, Nairobi.
Sudan's restated prime minister says he will have the authority to form his own independent government, according to the agreement he signed a day earlier with the country's top generals who overthrew him last month. This as the U.S., Britain and European Union and the United Nations welcomed the deal. In comments made during an interview with Al Jazeera English satellite channel that aired on Monday, Abdallah Hamdok says he sees the next government as focusing on rewriting the country's constitution and holding elections on time. But as Lucy Field of Reuters reports, protests continued with some pro-democracy groups accusing Hamdok of, quote, selling out the revolution, unquote.
Sudan's military may have reinstated its civilian prime minister, but that didn't keep pro-democracy protesters from the streets. Nearly a month of unrest has seen dozens of people killed. On Sunday, military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan signed an agreement to restore Abdallah Hamdok as the head of a transitional civilian government of technocrats and promised to release all political detainees. But as the deal was announced, demonstrators in Khartoum chanted that Hamdok had sold the revolution. Pro-democracy groups have been demanding full civilian rule since the ouster of longtime leader Omar al-Bashir in 2019. And protesters like Shahinaz Gamal want the military completely excluded from the political process.
We are marching towards the presidential palace to reject what is happening. Up ahead, we can hear the sound of tear gas and bullets. So we will continue resisting and we will not settle down until all militia groups are dissolved and until we completely exclude the military from the political process.
Tens of thousands took part in scheduled protests in the capital and twin cities Omdurman and Bahri. Witnesses said security forces fired bullets and tear gas. But Hamdok's reinstatement has been welcomed by the likes of the United States, Britain, the European Union and the United Nations. Western powers had condemned the October 25th coup, in which Hamdok was placed under house arrest, and suspended support for the economically struggling country. Hamdok said on Sunday he had agreed to the deal to prevent more casualties. Burhan says the new agreement will be inclusive, though it made no mention of the Forces of Freedom and Change. That is the civilian coalition that shared power with the military before the coup. The FFC said it did not recognize any agreement with the military.
In other news, Ethiopia's prime minister says he will lead his country's army, quote, from the battlefront, unquote, as of Tuesday, a dramatic new step by the Nobel Peace Prize winner in a devastating year-long war. Abiy Ahmed says in a statement that, quote, this is a time when leading a country with martyrdom is needed, unquote. With rival Tigray forces moving closer to the capital of Addis Ababa, his government this month declared a state of emergency. An estimated tens of thousands of people have been killed in the war between Ethiopia and the allied forces and fighters from the country's Tigray region. The United States and others warn that Africa's second most populous country could fracture in defining. His statement also claims that the West is trying to defeat Ethiopia, the latest pushback against what his government has described as meddling by the international community. Envoys from the African Union and the United States have continued diplomatic efforts in pursuit of a ceasefire to defining and talks about a political solution. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Okoh in Washington. A Sydney restaurant is using a Chinese-made multilingual hospitality robot to address chronic staff shortages as Australia's economy begins to recover from COVID-19 lockdowns and border closures. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The robot waiter is programmed to know the layout of the tables and delivers food from the kitchen. It's also multilingual, programmed to communicate in English and Mandarin. The so-called BellaBot is built by the Chinese firm Pudu Tech. Each machine costs about $17,000. They can be leased for $34 per day for each device, or the equivalent of 2 hours' wages for restaurant staff. The devices are in use in other Australian restaurants, and imports into Australia appear to be unaffected by recent trade tensions between the two countries. Leanne Shai, the co-owner of the Matterhorn restaurant in Sydney, is delighted with her new mechanical staff member.
Oh, love the robot. Love the robot. She makes my life a lot easier. It's like a tower that's got four trays that'll carry eight of our dinner plates in one go. She's geo-mapped to the floor. The robot knows where all our tables are.
Australia's hospitality workforce has traditionally relied on international students. They have, however, been restricted from entering after Australia closed its borders to most foreign nationals in March 2020 in an effort to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Labour shortages are affecting not only hospitality in Australia, but a range of industries, from construction to information technology. Leanne Shai says she's tried for months without success to recruit workers.
It's the biggest issue we have at the moment. We've been running ads for chefs, for waiters, for kitchen hands for 6 months, and we've had zero applicants. We're offering above award wages, we're offering bonuses, we're offering everything you can think of to attract appropriate staff. And I'm not even getting inappropriate staff or untrained staff. I'm just getting nobody.
Labour shortages should ease when Australia reopens its borders to foreign nationals, but analysts expect many vacancies will remain unfilled. Employer groups have demanded that Australia increase its intake of migrant workers. Australia's official unemployment rate stands at 5.2%. But with more than 700,000 Australians without a job, there are calls for the government to boost domestic training programs and wages. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
El Salvador's President Nayib Bukele says he plans to build the world's first, quote, Bitcoin city, unquote, funded initially by Bitcoin-backed bonds. This as an effort to fuel investment in the Central American country. Speaking at an event closing a week-long promotion of Bitcoin in El Salvador, Bukele says the city, planned in the eastern region of La Union, will get geothermal power from a volcano and will not levy any taxes except for value-added tax or VAT. Half of the VAT levied will be used to fund the bonds issued to build the city, and the other half will pay for services such as garbage collection. Bukele estimates that public infrastructure will cost around 300,000 bitcoins. El Salvador in September became the first country in the world to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender.
It's going to be right there in the Fonseca Gulf, and it's going to include everything, residential areas, commercial areas, services, museums, entertainment, bars, restaurants, airport, port, rail, everything devoted to Bitcoin. The only tax that you're going to have in Bitcoin City is the value-added tax, you know, normal value-added tax, 10%, which you would pay for, you know, if you buy a Coke, you pay 10%. And that value-added tax will be used, half of it, to pay the bonds that we're going to issue to build up the city, so it's going to pay for itself. And the other half will be transferred to the municipality, so they clean up the trash, they keep the parks nice, and they keep the city all neat and clean. Because this is a fully ecological city that works and it's energized by a volcano. That is just right in the side of the city. So that's Bitcoin City, everybody.
That's El Salvador President Nayib Bukele. Despite worldwide efforts to stop deforestation and curb air pollution, the Brazilian government says at least one-fourth of Brazil's 240 million people have gone back to using firewood for cooking. This is happening not only in Brazil's vast forests and rural areas, but also in Brazil's major cities, as Jan Bucket reports for VOA from Sao Paulo.
Tradiciana takes this bath at least once a week. Among the last areas of greenery in Brazil's largest city, he looks for firewood to cook meals for himself and his wife. Viana, along with 14% of the Brazilian population, is unemployed. He was fired from a public transport company where he worked as a driver earlier this year at the height of the coronavirus pandemic. A few months ago, his savings ran out. He only had money to buy gas or pay the bills. So he decided to buy gas, but realized that he could not go any further. He said he needed to find a solution. As he was unemployed with time, he decided to build this wood stove. Viana's improvised wood stove sits inside his home on the outskirts of São Paulo, home to more than 12 million people. The setup is precarious. The fire burns the wood just a few centimeters from the gas tank he still occasionally uses. He says firewood is the only way to save money to buy food and pay essential bills. But he complains about the difficulties that the return to the past also brings. He says it cooks slower. He had to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning and had to do some adjustments to make on the stove. He says if he was cooking on the gas stove, lunch would be ready sooner. With the wood stove, everything has to start earlier to be prepared on time. Juarez Viana is among many Brazilians who are switching from the traditional gas stove to wood to cook their food. According to figures from the Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics, at least 25% of the Brazilian population is using wood as their primary fuel for cooking. Adriana Gioda at the Pontifical Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro is the leading researcher on the residential use of firewood by Brazilian families. And these figures are from before the pandemic. She says it has increased more in the northeast region of Brazil because it is poorer. But what she observed is that the use grew in several big cities. In several metropolitan areas, people also started to use firewood. The expert adds the increased use of firewood is the result of the country's deep economic crisis and also the soaring price of cooking gas, which is following international market trends. In Jardim Marajoara, a poor neighborhood of migrants from the Brazilian northeast on the outskirts of São Paulo, it is difficult to find a family that has not used firewood in recent years. Silvani de Souza owns a small restaurant in the neighborhood. She says she's unemployed with two daughters, so she has to cook on the wood stove because she doesn't have money to buy gas every month. She says if she's cooking on gas, she would need a canister every 2 months. She would spend 120 reais, nearly $22, and she says she cannot afford it. De Souza has been cooking with wood for over a year. With inflation surpassing 10% in the last year, she wonders each day how she will survive as she burns her firewood, even though that means going against what most people would consider progress. Ian Boechat, VOA News, São Paulo.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
This is the voice of America. Washington, ba-ba-ba-zip.